evening. My name is T, and I am an alcoholic.
I'm
addicted to anything that makes me feel different. For me, I'm 58 years old and soon to be 59, and life is good now, only because I get out of the way. But I started drinking probably when I was about 10 years old. My mother used to come in and give me a shot of brandy or a shot of scotch or whatever whenever I complained about mouth pain. And I used to have a lot of mouth pain. And so my mother would come in and give me a shot, and I would then go off to sleep. I grew up in a place called New London, Connecticut. New London, Connecticut, during that time of the 50s and 60s, was a little small Navy town, and it probably had about 30,000 people there. I say 30,000 people, probably about 30,000 people that normally lived there. The rest were Navy and military. And we had the sub base, we had Pfizer's, we had Dow Chemical, and we had the Coast Guard Academy, we had Connecticut College, which was a girls' school, and that was pretty much it. And in growing up in Connecticut at that time during the 50s and 60s, my grandparents were pretty well off. I won't say that they were rich, but they were well off. They had inherited 300 acres, and at that time, when they inherited the 300 acres, it was a chicken farm, and it was my great-grandfather's. And my great-grandfather was a sharecropper from Virginia on my grandfather's side, and he had moved up here from Virginia and started this little chicken farm, and then the federal government decided that they were going to start building freeways all over the country. And so they built I-95 right through our front yard and right through our front part of the property, so my grandparents had to move. So the house that they bought was called, it was on Catherine Street, and Catherine Street was not even half a block from the beach. And it was kind of a cool place because me and my friends used to hang out at the beach, and my grandfather would never see us down there. We'd start fires and stuff there. And we'd get drunk, and we'd hang out, and sometimes we wouldn't get drunk, we'd get high, and we'd do those things out on the beach. And it was a pretty cool place. And for me, I was the only black kid in the neighborhood. I was the quintessential person, I guess, because I had blue eyes and blonde hair, and everybody couldn't figure out who I was or what I was. And a lot of times I'd be called a zebra. My mother had red hair. And my mother was light-complected, and my grandmother had blonde hair and blue eyes. And, I was in the mix. and the other thing was that I went to Catholic school. And in going to Catholic school, Catholic kids are pretty, pretty insensitive. I'm sorry, but we are. And my first name is Theodore, but they used to call me the Odor. And my last name was Hard Rick. You lose that last R, and you got Hard Dick. And they used to call me the Odor Hard Dick, for me, I had to learn how to defend myself real early on in age. I started taking martial arts when I was about 3 years old. I lived with my aunt and my uncle. My uncle became the sergeant major of the army, and his wife was Japanese, and I really had people confused when they'd see my aunt. I am, here she is picking me up, and she's this little Japanese lady, and I'm this blonde-headed kid with blue eyes, and where did she come from? Where did he come from? And I used to get that quite a bit. And in going to Catholic school, I was the only African-American male in the school. I went to St. Mary's. There was two Catholic schools in our town. One was St. Mary's, and one was St. Joe's, and New London is like 6 square miles, so it's about as big as Lemon Grove. It's not that big, And all of my friends, their dads were cops. And my mother and I never lived really together. I lived with my grandparents. It was easier for me to live with my grandparents because my mother worked two jobs. One of the jobs she worked was at Pratt & Whitney, and she built engines for aircraft. And the other job that she worked was she was a waitress, and she worked all kinds of hours. And most of the time, she wouldn't get home until midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning. And then she'd get up in the morning and go to work at Pratt & Whitney, which was about another 50 miles away. So I would never see my mother, and she always had rotating days off. So even if she was off from Pratt & Whitney on the weekend, she was still working her, or waitress job. And her and my dad divorced when I was 3 years old, so that was another thing. I blame myself for that divorce, even though I had nothing to do with it. You know, I blame myself for my dad not being around. And the kids used to pick on me because of that, because I didn't have a dad around, you know. And like I said, I learned how to fight when I was 3 years old. And I started building on that arsenal of defense. I had my first black belt by the time I was 7 years old, and I had my second black belt by the time I was 14, et cetera, et cetera. Today I got 7 black belts in martial arts, and I don't use my skills anymore. I gave up my skills a long time ago because I basically abused my skills. When I was drinking, I would go to bars and look for the biggest guy in there. And if you were one of those people that I hurt when I was out there drinking, I really seriously, honestly apologize to you because I did it quite often. I have a stepbrother. His name is Steve, who lives here in San Diego. He will not go out with me, period. He won't drive in the car with me. he won't do a lot of things with me, but today it's different. Steve's got 13 years of sobriety, and we can hang out together. You know, but for a long time we couldn't, because when I was left to my own devices, I was self-destructing all the time. You know, I tried a lot of different things when I was coming along. When I graduated from high school, I went to Connecticut College. It became a co-ed school, and I got in because my grandmother was the dietitian there. And, you know, it was offered to or extended to family members that you could go to school free of charge. They paid for everything except for books, and all I had to do was pay for my own books. And my freshman year, I was doing pretty good, with the exception of I had the same math teacher for 4 years in high school. And when I got into college, here he was again for another class, you know. And it was like, I can't deal with Mr. Crosby again. So I dropped my math class, and 3 weeks later I got this letter from Uncle Sam which said greeting. Didn't say greetings, it said greeting. You are hereby inducted into the United States military, or United States Army. Your report to Union Training Station at 6 a.m. on May the 15th, and go to the military station in New Haven, Connecticut, where they did all of the physicals and everything there. Yeah, and then from there I was to go to Fort Dix, New Jersey. Well, you know, my uncle, who became the sergeant major of the Army, I asked him for a favor, and he got me a favor. You know, I had asked him for an easier position, and he gave me an easier position. He got me into the 82nd Airborne. You know, basic training wasn't all that tough for me, but, you know, it was hard. And there again, I go to that place of, I was a light-complected, blue-eyed kid with blonde hair, you know, and where do I fit? You know, I was drinking. My best friend, let me back up a little bit. My best friend became a Rhodes Scholar. He went to Wesleyan University. His name was Ray McDonald. And this kid, he could have became anything or anybody he wanted to become. In high school, he had straight A's, you know, never had to study, always was Mr. Athlete and everything like that. And, you know, and I did have to study a little bit. I didn't have to study a whole lot, but I did have to study a little bit, especially when it came to chemistry. I did not like chemistry, didn't like physics, and I did okay in math. You know, but Ray was just one of these kids that, you know, look at the book once and put it down and take the test the next day, and he was getting A's, you know. And he got accepted into Wesleyan, and he got a full scholarship. And Ray and I used to do a lot of things together. We used to hitchhike all over the East Coast. You know, we went to New York City, and the drinking age in New York was like 14 years old at the time. So we used to hitchhike down to New York all the time with our backpacks on back, and we'd get a whole lot of alcohol and hitchhike back to New London. It was only 150 miles, so we could do that in an evening, you know. So Friday night, we'd set off about 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, heading to New York. We'd get down to New York, we'd buy our alcohol, come back and sell it, you know. And by midnight, I was drunk, you know. Ray would have to take me home. And my grandfather was one of these downstairs in the basement drinkers. You know, he'd go downstairs in the basement, he'd always buy a pint of alcohol and a six pack of beer, and that would last him 2 days. You know, and he'd sit down in the basement, smoke his cigar and drink his liquor, and I would basically drink my own. You know, in this particular time, during that time, I can't tell you how much I was drinking, but I know I was drinking a lot. My grandmother, who I was very close to, she was my mother. She wasn't my grandmother, she was my mother. She raised me, she did everything for me, and I lived with her from the time that my uncle put me out, which was probably about 6 years old when he started going back and forth to Vietnam. And I lived with my grandparents from then until I graduated from high school. My grandmother passed in my junior year, I believe it was. And when she passed, I drank that whole week. They had a gallon of scotch, and I drank that whole bottle of scotch. And as I was drinking it, I was pouring water in it, you know, just trying to dilute it so my grandfather wouldn't know I was drinking. But somehow or another, he knew I was doing that because he, you know, he was making his little trips upstairs to try and get his little sip in too, you know. And this one particular day, he said to me, "How come you're drinking?" And I looked at him and I said, "I'm hurting." And he goes, "You don't hurt, you don't feel. You got your pain, you can live with it." And it wasn't like that for me. I couldn't live with my pain. You know, my pain was pretty much in my heart. You know, I felt like I was hurting my family. I felt like everybody in the world didn't understand, and they did. My uncles, my aunts, everybody's in my family were pretty much understanding, but they didn't understand why I was doing the things I was doing. I was basically snorting a lot of dope-based turpentine. That was one of the things that I was doing. I was skipping school. I wasn't doing well in school. My grades went from about a B average to went from about a B average to probably down to a high F. And in the process, my life went from a B average down to a high F. You know, nobody wanted me around, you know. It was really, really bad. It was not a good thing, you know. And I got cast off between aunt and uncle and different people. And then I had a breakdown, a real bad breakdown. And at that time, they didn't have sanitariums. They had what they would call, I would call nut houses. It was called Norwich State Hospital. And they put me in there. And they didn't have an age limit. It wasn't about you're under 18 years old. You can't come in here. And they put me in there for 2 weeks. And they put me in this unit where everybody that was in the unit had a lobotomy. And that's when they removed the frontal lobe of the brain. And people just basically just walk around slurring and dripping and drooling and slobbering and not comfortable, you know. And to have a kid, you know, who basically is under sedation. They kept me sedated for the first week, and I don't remember anything except for they had this food, and it was lima beans, and the lima beans was like in this tomato sauce, and it was nasty. And I remember, I don't remember what I did with them, but I remember I wasn't eating them. And to me, every meal that they had was lima beans and tomato sauce, and so I wasn't eating, you know. And then the doctor told me, he said, "Well, you can't go home until you start eating." And it's like, you know. And then there was this guy, his name was Mike, and I remember giving him the lima beans and the tomato sauce and telling the doctor I was eating. And they had seen me do this all the time with this guy, you know. And so when I got out of there, I was seeing a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist, I used to call the Mad Russian. He was from Russia. I didn't understand a damn word he said, but, you know, he was cool, you know. He was my psychiatrist. And he always used to call me a good kid. Well, that was his opinion of me, you know. But my opinion was not that I was a good kid, not that I was a bad kid. It was just that, you know, I didn't want what you had, and I didn't want what anybody else had, and I didn't want those people that were in my family, because they were all opinionated. And I surely didn't want the people that were at the Catholic Church, you know. I remember one time we were having a spitting contest, and Sister Ignatia Marie came around the corner just as I was spitting, and we were spitting on the church. And we got busted for that, and needless to say, she caught me. She didn't catch anybody else, you know. And then I was an altar boy, and when being an altar boy, I stole a bottle of wine. And Father Uzenza beat me home after he did the wine count, you know, and he wanted to know where that bottle of wine was, and we had drank it, but, I mean, like, that was some of the nastiest wine you ever bought. And it was like, why did I even steal this stuff? You know, but for me, you know, drinking started when I was real young. Like I said, I was about 10 years old when I first had my first drink, and it didn't stop. You know, it just got progressively worse, you know. And graduation night from high school, you know, you have your prom, and I remember my prom, we didn't go to New York that weekend, but my mother had caught me with 4 pints of Jack Daniels, and I had them inside my jacket pocket and in my back pocket, and she went to hug me, and when she went to hug me, she felt these hard things in my pocket, and she opened up my jacket, and here's the bottle of Jack Daniels, and so she took that out of my pocket, found the other one over here, and then she searched me, you know, and got my bottles of Jack Daniels. So I went to the prom with nothing to sell and nothing in my pockets, you know. So I ended up buying a bottle of slow gin fizz. Hot slow gin fizz. And if you've ever had slow gin fizz, hot, I'll tell you what, it goes down nice, and it comes back worse. I ended up finding myself in the punch bowl that night, and I was just slung over the punch bowl, and nobody wanted any punch after I finished with it. You know, and I had a friend of mine, his name was Buddy, and he had a Volkswagen, and he was the designated driver that night. And I drank the slow gin fizz. That didn't stay down with me. I drank beer that night. I can't tell you what I drank, but I drank a whole lot that night. You know, and then I didn't drink again for about a week, but I did a lot of smoking. We used to go to Eugene O'Neill Theater, and friends of ours used to bring in marijuana. And we used to go over to the Eugene O'Neill Theater, which was a big playwright deal, and we'd used to sit over there and watch the plays and smoke. You know, and this particular night, it was just before graduation, and I had a physics exam. And all year during physics, I never once studied. And we had that pre-thing that the teacher always goes through where he warms you up before you take the test, and he started asking questions, and I was firing off the answers, and he said to me, "It looks like you studied." And I was like, "Don't hold your breath on this one." And I took my physics exam, and I passed it, you know, without studying. Marijuana was great. You know, it was one of them good deals. But the thing was, I got kind of paranoid because when I went up, I didn't come back down until about 3 o'clock the next afternoon. You know, and I was really scared, you know, and that was my first time in doing that. And I tried everything, including going to the liquor store. And back in Connecticut, they had package stores. And the package stores would open up at 8 o'clock in the morning and close at 8 o'clock at night. And they weren't open on Sunday. Sunday they were closed, but you can get liquor all the time. And there was this one liquor store that, because of my hair, I had an afro which was about yay big, you know, and people used to think I was older than what I really was. You know, it wasn't until I got drafted that afro went away, and then, you know, it was a trip. You know, it was, that afro used to protect me a lot. You know, I could hide everything in that afro. You know, so then my family moved out here to California, and I was living with my aunt and uncle at the time. And my uncle was an electrical engineer, and he was one of the first electrical black engineers to break the color barrier. And the company that he worked for at first, he got the job before I got the job, he was working for Litton Industries, and they moved us out here from Connecticut. And I didn't start working for Litton until, I was 21, and for my 21st birthday, I was working at Litton, and they were giving me all kinds of overtime. Any kind of overtime I wanted, I got. So I was able to buy my first new car, my first brand new car. It was a Buick Grand Sport. Ordered it from the factory. It cost me $3,800, you know, and it had a stick shift. It was white leather interior, only it was pleather. It wasn't real leather at the time, and or Naugahyde, that's what it was. And it was a blue exterior. Pretty car, pretty car. And I bought that car, and I put $1,200 cash down on the car, and then I paid it off within a year or something. Imagine a brand new car for $4,000. You know, you don't see that anymore. And that was my first love, I guess. Even though I had other loves with cars, that was my first love here in California. And we lived up in L.A., and we lived in Inglewood, right on the border of Inglewood and Hawthorne. And I still was fixated on marijuana. And we lived about, 6 or 7 blocks from the Inglewood Police Department. And the Inglewood, or the Hawthorne Airport, was right almost in our front yard. And they used to land the helicopter for the Inglewood Police Department right there. And when the helicopter would take off from the airport, it would go down our street. You know, flying, maybe 65, 70 feet above our house. And I grew these three plants out in our backyard, and you know, we had a lemon tree, and I bought these seeds from Connecticut. My aunt kept asking me, "What are you growing?" And I would say, "Weeds." And she would say, "You sure it's not watermelon?" "Nope, it's weeds." And I kept saying this. Finally, these weeds got to be over the fence, you know. And the helicopter's going by our house every day, and sometimes it would go kind of slow, and I'd be looking down in my yard, you know. And my aunt and my uncle had a top secret security clearance at Litton. And I'll never forget this particular day. I was sitting in the room, and I was having a nice beer with my cousin, and I was playing chess, and I was over 21, so I could do this. And my uncle was a full-blown alcoholic, and so Saturdays and Sundays was his days to get lit. And we were sitting there playing chess, and all of a sudden, my family calls me TG. They don't call me Theodore. They don't call me anything but TG. You know, and when they call me TG, I know something's wrong. You know, my aunt screamed TG at that time, and she had the newspaper in her hand, and it was the Los Angeles Times. And in the Los Angeles Times, they had done an expose on marijuana. What it looked like, how it grows, the whole 9 yards. And she was asking me, point blank, face to face, "My aunt's only about 5'2", 5'3", what it was that I was growing in the backyard. And I told her I was growing weeds. And she called my uncle, and it was Herman. And Herman came in, and, you know, he was under the influence, and he said, "Don't you know I could lose my top secret security clearance?" And I didn't say a word. And then he just kept on going, and then she went out, and she snatched those plants up out of the ground, broke them up, put them in a plastic bag, and shoved them down in the trash can. Well, the trash can was underneath my bedroom window. And I waited until they went to sleep. Went out, pulled them out. Next day, I didn't go to work. I had an upset stomach. And she was teaching school at that time, so I put them in the oven, dried them out, and smoked that stuff for the next year. You know, and my aunt never knew anything different, you know, but at the same time, I was drinking. I was drinking vodka at the time. And for me, vodka was just something that I would do probably on the weekends or at parties, and I wouldn't do it a whole lot, but because I was going to school at the time. And for me, you know, I started getting into different things, including I started getting these militant ideas, and I started going to Black Panther meetings, and they started telling me that I couldn't drink the vodka, but I could do other things. And, you know, I started getting a little bit more militant, and I didn't feel comfortable. Did not feel comfortable, you know, and my militancy only lasted about 6 months. And after the 6 months, I had to do something different. And for me, my different was I started hanging around with different people, and I pledged with a fraternity at the time, which really took me totally out of the militancy and started turning me around back towards education, and I stopped drinking a lot, and I stopped doing a lot of things for about 8 months when I was pledging this fraternity. And, my life got a little bit different, and my grades got better, too. And 1975, I got out of school, and I went to work for Security Pacific Bank. And it was a good run. I worked for Security Pacific Bank. I became an area manager. But the thing was, I had this friend. His name was Cliff. And we used to drink. Up in L.A., they used to have these restaurants which were in trains. You remember, I don't know if you guys remember, it was like a caboose. And we used to have these liquid lunches, you know. We called ourselves having a business meeting, and we'd spend about $300 a day just sitting there drinking. What were we drinking? We were drinking, it was a liqueur, and I'll think about it in a second. And we used to drink bottles and bottles and bottles of this stuff. And I got hurt. I shattered my spine. I had a Datsun Z, and this girl was doing like 30 miles an hour in reverse. And she hit the front end of my car, and I shattered my spine. And during that whole accident, I was in so much shock, I just didn't realize that I was hurting. And they took me to the hospital. I went to Bellflower Community Hospital, and I had this little surgeon. I used to call him the elf. But he was like 5 foot, and he was Hispanic, and he had his real strong Hispanic accent, but he was good. He was really good, and he did the surgery on my spine. And when I was in the hospital, I was in the hospital for 45 days, and they had me in this hoop. And every 4 hours, they would come in, and they would turn me like I was on a barbecue spit, you know. And Cliff used to come and see me every single day, and he would bring this bottle of, and I still can't think of the name of it, but I will. Sauvignon. Don's. Shucks. It was a liqueur. I'll come with it in a minute. Anyhow, he used to bring a bottle of that every single day, and I was on Demerol, and I had no need for alcohol, but me and Cliff were drinking that stuff every single night, you know, and the nurses couldn't figure out why I was getting wild. You know, I was doing some wild, wild stuff in this hospital. This was 77. And I was doing some wild stuff. I wasn't walking, but I was doing some wild stuff. And every night, Cliff would bring in another bottle, and we'd sit there and we'd drink. And my girlfriend was sneaking in the marijuana, and I had a private room so I could close the doors, and I'd have my girlfriend put the towels over there, and I'd sit there and I'd drink this stuff, and I would just get there, you know. And this one particular weekend, I got out of the hospital, and I had gotten my car back, and I had a Datsun Z, and I had gotten my car back from the shop, and I wasn't supposed to drive, and I was under the influence of the Demerol, I was under the influence of the alcohol, I was under the influence of the marijuana, and don't ask me how I drove home, but I did. And I don't remember anything for about a week, and I ended up buying a ticket to Mexico. We went to Mexico for a month, and while I was in Mexico for that month, we went to Mexico City first. And for the first part of that time, I got asked never to come back to Mexico again. Because when I arrived there, I bought one of those skins, you know, the wine skins, and I filled it with vodka and Kahlua. And I had this drink. It was vodka, Kahlua, and orange juice. Yeah, I know. It was nasty. But it would take me there real quick. And the stewardess couldn't figure out how I was getting a buzz before they even started going around, you know, can I get you a drink, sir? Oh, no, I got my own, thank you. You know, and this was going on, and I started, I was down there with a group of people. We were down there for a month, and like I said, we were staying in the Mexico City Hyatt Regency, and they had this onyx statues in every room. And I was trying to steal this shit. And I had it all packed up in my bags. And this particular day, the guy comes in and he goes to lift my bag up and he couldn't get it up off the ground. And he looked around and he goes, "Sir, I can't lift your bag, and it's a lot heavier than what it was when I bought it in here." You know, and you could see the bulge in the bag. Come on. You know, and it was like, "Sir, I'll be back in a few minutes. You need to unload some of this stuff in your bag." You know, and then next thing I know, I got downstairs, and they had the police there, and they had everybody there, and we were on our way to Acapulco, and they were asking me, "Please, don't go to Acapulco. Go back to California. Don't come back here no more." You know, and that's the way that I was living. I was living on the edge, you know, and I had this place in Culver City, and I used to have my friends come in and rip it off every 6 months, and I used to have insurance on it, and the insurance company, you know, I charged them $10,000 every 6 months for, you know, my friends coming in and ripping my stuff off, you know, and it wasn't getting better. You know, my life was not getting any better, and I was just getting crazier and crazier and crazier and crazier. And then my girlfriend decided she was going to ask me if I would get married. And I was like, "Oh, you know, I like this girl, but I'm not getting married, you know." So I went back to Connecticut because my stepsister was getting married, and I had received this invitation. And my dad, all he had to do was say to me, "Son, I need you." And I stayed. I went back to California one day. I packed up my stuff. I had the moving company come and get it. I got a quote from them for $4,500. And they were going to move all of my stuff back to Connecticut. And I had a lot of stuff. And they got back to Connecticut, and they told me that it was no longer $4,500, but it was $10,000. I said, "Well, you keep your shit and just take it to the storage, because I don't want it." And the guy was like, "You got all of this stuff?" And I was like, "Okay, I got it. Take it. I'll make storage payments on it." And I never did, you know. And I stayed back in Connecticut for 3 years. I had inherited a house from my grandparents, which was 4 acres on the river, and it was just a nice house. And it was a great house. I had deer running across the property, and I had pheasants running across the property, and I used to like to raise the bathroom window and shoot whatever was running across the property. And my nutism was getting worse, you know. And I had met this young lady, and she had two little boys, and they were just sweet little boys. And she asked me to get married, and I said, "Okay, I'll let you know my answer tomorrow." And the next day came, and I was back in California. You know, and then this was about 1978, 79, and I met a few people. My mother was working catering at the time, and I had a friend, John over here, and John was working catering also, and for some unknown reason, John liked me, you know, and he used to take care of me all the time, you know, I mean all the time. I would get into so much trouble, but John would take care of me for some whatever reason. He would take care of me, you know, and I used to do things like start fights and drink on the job. And then my boss started promoting me, and she started giving me different positions, and she started sending me out on the parties as the party manager. And I was working for the University of California as a police officer. So I had two jobs. And my drinking didn't get better. My drinking got a lot worse. And I was working at the university and doing catering also. And I had been at the university since 1980, and I was their bomb squad technician. And one particular incident happened where I went out, and I took off my blast shield and my gloves, and the item that I was disposing, the alarm went off on it. And I'm walking across with this item, and I stopped because the alarm was going off in my hand, and I was under the influence. I was very much under the influence. There wasn't a day that I drew a sober breath. There wasn't a night that I went to bed that I just passed out, you know. And this particular incident was a sobering event, to say the least, because the alarm went off on this little device, which I had deemed safe. And what it was a box, about a shoebox size. And the kids had painted these wooden dolls and put wax on the ends and wires to them, and it looked sort of like they were dynamite. And there was a timing device inside this little box, and they had wires to the little timing device. And the alarm went off, and all I could do was stand still, not move. And as I was standing still, I pissed on myself. And that was about all I could do, because I knew that I had screwed up. I had screwed up real bad. I knew that this thing was going to blow up, because I had never had anything alarm in my hands before like that. And I stood there for what seemed like an eternity, and this thing was ringing in my hand, and everybody around me was just frozen, and I was frozen. And then nothing happened, and somebody said, T. And I guess that's when I refocused myself, and when I refocused myself, I realized that this wasn't blowing up, and I was still me. And I had this thing in one hand, and I went like that to touch myself, and I realized that I was still okay. And I took it outside, and we disposed of it, and I got suspended. And the reason I got suspended was for being under the influence. And then I got back to work after a month suspension, and I got suspended again. And it was just like a game I was playing with my sergeant. I was getting suspended left and right. And then the last suspension, I had been over in the parking lot, and I had rolled two joints, and I had put them in my pocket. He came up in back of me, and he jumped in the car, and he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm getting ready to make a patrol through the parking lot. I was just doing my paperwork. He goes, meet me back at the station. Got back at the station. They searched me, and they found the two joints. My blood alcohol level was probably 0.30, and they suspended me again, only this time was the final suspension. And in my catering thing that I was doing, you know, that became my full-time job. And I started abusing that. I started abusing my friend. And John was about the only friend I had. I didn't have too many other friends except for my mother, you know. And mothers are sometimes the last ones to not be your friend, you know. And we worked for the America's Cup, and I was the catering person that was in charge of security and catering, and I was the liaison between the two. And I used to get a lot of perks, you know, and one of the biggest perks was that Dennis liked me. I don't know why, but, you know, we became okay. And when he went to Down Under, he came back with this red rum. And it was during a parade of lights, and we needed a bartender out on the boat, and John volunteered to be the bartender. And I was sitting back there, and I was just as happy as a pig and whatever, just playing it up on the back of the boat, drinking this red rum, you know. And I had stopped drinking hard alcohol in 1980, and I started drinking wine and beer, and I thought maybe that would change my personality, because the vodka was really doing a job on me. The vodka was doing such a job on me, and it was changing my personality so bad that, you know, I was mean. I was actually mean. And you could smell the vodka coming out of my pores, you know. And so I started drinking this wine, and I met my wife when I got fired from catering, and I got fired from the police department. I went to work at a private security, and I worked at this hospital over on 25th and Market Street, which was, this place here was like the wild, wild west, and every night they were shooting at you. Every night there was gunfire. Every night, if it wasn't for this wall, you were going to get shot. And, I mean, like, it was bad out there. It was on 25th and Market Street, and I met my wife, and I gave her this card, and I had worked as a publisher for a magazine for a year, and I got fired from that. And all the jobs that I had, I got fired from, and they were all good jobs, you know, but I kept getting fired from them because I was drinking, and I couldn't figure it out. My drinking and my drugging was taking me further and further down the road. And then I met my wife, and my wife was like, oh, wow. You know, she didn't realize that I was drinking as much as I was drinking, and I used to hide it from her. We had a dishwasher, and I used to put a gallon bottle of Carlo Rossi in the dishwasher, and I used to have this little pint bottle or whatever you call it, and I used to keep that full in the refrigerator, you know, and I used to have this Pepsi cup, and this Pepsi cup was what I used to carry around with me all the time, and that's what I used to drink. I used to fill it up with the wine, and I would drive with it, and I would go every place with it, and I got my second DUI. and it was within a year of leaving the police department. And they arrested me, and I had this Toyota pickup truck. And they took me down to the jail, and I told you that I had 7 black belts. And this particular night, my second DUI, cop decided to get rough with me, and I decided this isn't going to happen. And so what happened was, as he was pushing me in to my cell, I just swung around and I grabbed his arm and I threw him in and I started walking out the shell. And all of a sudden, he said something and there was like a swarm of cops. And after 4 of them, there was like 12 of them. And then after 12, there was like 20 of them. And it just seemed like they were just coming in waves, you know. And it was like, I can't fight this. And I actually stopped. And I got beat up a little bit, you know. And then what else happened was they put me in jail for a month. And when I got out of that jail cell, I came home, and my wife, because I hadn't taken a shower for a whole month, my wife smelled me, and she said, "You take your clothes off right out there." You know, and so I did. And I took my clothes off right on the front porch, and we lived in this apartment over in Lemon Grove. And I took off all of my clothes, and I went running into the bathroom. And I wasn't convinced that I needed to quit drinking, it just got worse, progressively worse. I would go see this judge, and this judge would give me time. He would sentence me to go do some more community service work, and I would do the community service work, and I would show up under the influence of doing this community service work, and they'd send me back to the judge because they could smell the alcohol on me. And it just continued, you know. And my wife used to work for Las Colinas, and she was a nurse out at Las Colinas. And this one particular day, Liquor Barn was open. And DiSerrano was the alcohol that I couldn't remember a minute ago. And I went to the Liquor Barn and I bought a case of wine, and it was coming in gallon jugs. And I was drinking Carlo Rossi, the best stuff you could possibly buy, for $2.99. And I'm walking down Spring Street, and I got this case of wine on my shoulder, and I'm walking down Spring Street, and my wife gets off the 94 freeway, and she sees me, and she just keeps on going. And I'm yelling, "Hey, Jack!" And she just keeps on going. I get home, and I said to her, I said, "How come you didn't wait?" She said, "You didn't look like you needed any help." And so, you know, my drinking, it went on for a while. And then there was a couple of doctors at Physicians and Surgeons Hospital that used to work over at Alvarado Parkway Institute. And they always used to tell me, "We can get you over to Alvarado API. And get you squared away." And I kept saying, "Yeah, that's a bunch of fahooey." You know, because when I was in the mental institution, that's one of the places that they sent me was to AA. And over the years, I had gone to AA on a number of occasions, and I didn't want anything you guys had. I mean, like, every time I even thought about AA, I would get the cringes. And the other side of that was I was angry at God. I was really, really angry at God. You know, even though I was Catholic, I was angry because I felt that I got slighted. I felt as though God had left me out in the backyard someplace. It wasn't until 1989, someplace in there, that something clicked. The first thing that clicked was my wife presented me with a baby boy. You know, and this baby boy was my world. And this baby boy I was doing everything for, but I was still drinking. And I was working days, and my wife was working nights. And this particular one night, I'll never forget this, I got drunk while I was cooking dinner, and I was cooking some pork chops. And I fell asleep while I was cooking these pork chops. And I passed out. And my wife came home. She got off work early this particular night, and I'm laying across the bed, out of it, and she walks in and she starts beating the shit out of me. I mean, punching me, full on punching me. And I wake up and I'm ready to start fighting, and all of a sudden she's saying, "Look at this house, it's filled with smoke," and the smoke was just thick. And the alarm, the smoke detector, must have been ringing for about 2 or 3 hours, and my son was in his room screaming at the top of his lungs. And I had fallen asleep, and Tyler was less than a year old at the time, and I had fallen asleep, and she came home, and like I said, the house was filled with smoke, and the pork chops were on the stove, and they were gone. And everything was just bad. She came in, and like I said, she just beat the hell out of me. And I woke up, and when I woke up, I woke up to this house filled with smoke. And Tyler was in his room screaming, and she went in and got Tyler. And I had to do something, and I opened the doors, and I turned on the fan, and the smoke detector was going off. So I had to pull down the smoke detector and take the battery out of it, you know, and the smoke was just billowing out of the house. And my next-door neighbors weren't responding because they knew that if they did, they would have had to call the police, and the police would have come, and I would have lost my son. And my wife kicked me out of the house. And, you know, and then we sort of talked about it later, and I said, okay, I'll go to treatment. And she dropped me off at API. And that's what she did. She dropped me off at API, and during visiting hours she would come, but then came a time, you know, when they allow you to go home on a pass, and it was like she wouldn't bring me home. I'd have to go to my mother's house. We'd eat over at my mother's house, and finally after 30 days they let me out, and my wife wasn't satisfied that I was, you know, not drinking, because I was still crazy. I mean, like, I didn't want nothing you guys had, you know, because prior to going into treatment, I was coming to AA meetings, and on my way home or on my way to, I'd stop at the liquor store, you know, and I would have a drink or two or three or four or five or six. And then finally, you know, somewhere along the line, I met this person, and her name was Tracy. And Tracy and I was doing, like, four meetings a day, you know, and we'd sit by my dumpster because we lived in an apartment building, and we'd talk about AA. And I didn't want to talk about AA, and I didn't want to talk about God, and neither did she. You know, but somehow or another, we managed to put this time together where we started going to meetings all the time and doing something in order to stay sober. And we went to the Lemon Grove, the Lano Club, and we went to all over the place. And then one day, and I don't know what happened, and I don't know why it happened, but it was about a year after I had been out of treatment that I started turning that corner. And when I started turning that corner, it was like, wow. This is what it's like to live alcohol and drug free. And the judge, his name was Harvey Heiber, and he was one of us. And one particular day we were doing a Sunday morning meeting, and I looked up, and here he is sitting next to my drug and alcohol counselor. And my drug and alcohol counselor was just one fine woman. And I found out later that it was his wife. And I also found out that he was one of us. And I also found out, you know, that he and I became friends, and then he started drug court, and he asked my help, and I became a drug and alcohol counselor first, and then after becoming a drug and alcohol counselor, I became an addiction specialist, you know, and my road has been one that has just been phenomenal. My 18-year-old son has never seen me drink. He's never seen me use, but he's seen my behavior, because some of my worst behavior comes as a direct result of who I am and what I got going on up here. And today, I have a 6-year-old, and oh my, does she remind me of me? Yes, she does, you know, and she knows who she is, where she's coming from, and what she believes in, you know, and she stands very firm on what her attitudes are, and, you know, this child, both of my children have seen Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, have been to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, have been with me on specific calls. My son used to go on a lot of different calls with me, including suicide attempts. You know, so he knows the field that I'm in, you know. And I can honestly tell you that today I wouldn't live my life in another way. You know, 4 years ago I got punched in the head by a psychotic patient, and he rocked my world. And I've been living with a lot more pain than I normally live in. I suffer from headaches daily. I suffer from brain pain daily. But you know, my doctor and I, my pain specialist and I fight about me taking this narcotic medication, and I won't take it. You know, and when I do take it, it's regulated. And where I'm going with that is, I don't want to go back to where I came from because I know what it looks like. Where I came from is dark. Where I came from is dingy. Where I came from is not a nice place. And to be in this place today, this is like being on vacation. You know, and for me, being here today is a miracle. And I want to thank you very much for letting me be here. I want to thank you very much for being a part of my world for the last 18 years. And I want to thank you for being my friend.